Hey there, Marco here. Before we start the show, I have some great news to share amongst all the chaos. We surpassed our end-of-year campaign goal. Yep, as you know, since October, we asked you every week to contribute to the work we're doing, and from across the globe, you answered the call. Together, we have raised over $130,000, a truly incredible show of support from you. Not only does it keep the engine of the production going, but it reminds our whole team that you are out there listening, and that what we do at The World matters to you. So from everyone here in our newsroom, we just can't thank you enough. Now, on to the show.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. China seems to have the coronavirus under control. The nation has reported less than 100,000 cases. Compare that with 23 million here in the U.S. But this week, a lockdown took effect in China. It's in Hebei province in northern China after nearly 500 people tested positive. Mainland China also reported its first official COVID death in nearly 8 months. Rebecca Canther is in Shanghai. Rebecca, one death from COVID seems like a very low number compared to what we're experiencing here in the U.S. Is it seen that way in China?
No. Officials here had thought they had largely, you know, won the war on COVID, but one death and 500 positive cases is very scary for officials here because that's the first death since May of last year. These are the highest COVID positive numbers they've had in 10 months. So in the past week, they put 28 million people on lockdown in several cities in northern China. And that's more than double the amount of people that were initially on lockdown in Wuhan last year.
Wow, that's incredible. But just compared to here, it's just so different.
Yes. You know, the Chinese government really wants to make sure things are under control. And so, you know, for the past months have been really, really tight on testing people coming into the country, trying to keep those numbers down. And, you know, in cases of minor outbreaks, doing mass testing. And they did that again during this outbreak. And here's a vlogger interviewing someone in the lockdown area earlier this week about his experience. So what he's saying is that in his housing community, several thousands of people needed to stand in line for hours till the middle of the night to do testing. And now they're on lockdown, so people can enter their community but not leave. Now, this is certain parts of China, not all of China, and it's really quite contained in specific areas where there are new cases. So while there are many people on lockdown in certain parts of China, in other parts of China, life is going on quite as normal.
Yeah, I understand you actually were traveling this week, which surprised me.
Yeah, so, you know, although there's an outbreak in northern China, I really wanted to go back to Wuhan because the one-year anniversary is approaching, and I wanted to see what it's like there a year later. You know, so I did all the preparations beforehand. I got a COVID test. I brought the results with me. You know, I was wearing masks. And I have to say, I knew that things there were largely returned back to normal, but I have to say I was surprised to see it with my own eyes. So this is a craft brewery that I stopped by earlier this week. It's in a soft opening, but you can hear it's packed with people. None of them were wearing masks. Of course, on the street, people are wearing masks, and, you know, people are taking precautions. Nobody wants a repeat of last year.
Still, just hearing that you went inside a place and there's lots of people at a craft brewery with no masks on, that's a pretty dramatic image. It's not something we'd see here.
Yeah. I mean, it felt very largely like it was normal and relaxed. Although I had one more interview to do before heading back to Shanghai, and that meant I had to walk through this small alleyway. And that's when I realized that the level of precautions was just ratcheting up as I was there. And so this is what happened when I was trying to enter an alleyway, and there was a checkpoint set up, manned by four people, and when they saw me, they were got a little bit out of sorts. So this is them asking me, what are you here to do? They're asking me, are you living in Wuhan? Where are you coming from? How did you get here? What train did you come on? What car did you come on? Do you have a green health code? Where are you staying? Who are you visiting? They're just a barrage of questions as they try to ascertain what I'm doing in that alley. This felt very much like, to me, how things had been a year ago. I hadn't felt that way, or I had that kind of an interrogation for a long time. And so it just made it very clear that, okay, the anxiety level is jumping up a notch or two, and they don't want to have another lockdown. They don't want to let up their guard.
So you were just walking through an alley in Wuhan, and that's where this all took place?
Yeah, it was a good 15, 20 minutes before it all got resolved. But I was able to get through.
Now, I know that China is approaching Chinese New Year, a major holiday. Will public health precautions affect people's holiday plans? It's traditionally a time where many Chinese travel all over the country.
Yes, that is what is on everybody's mind right now. So schools are about to go on vacation. People are already thinking about, you know, whether they're going to visit their families. And this is, you know, the largest annual migration in the world as people are heading home for Chinese New Year. Places like Shanghai are strongly urging people not to travel for the holiday. They're warning of quarantines on their return. My kids' school has, I don't know how many times they've called me up. They've told the kids, do not leave town. And for people who want to leave town, they're probably going to wait until the last minute to book their tickets just to make sure that they can go. And also, the government is trying to vaccinate a huge amount of people in advance of the holiday. I read on Reuters they've given 10 million doses, and that's the majority just in January alone.
The World's Rebecca Kanther telling us about precautions in China as it responds to some new cases of COVID-19. Thanks a lot, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Next to Brazil, another coronavirus outbreak there is hitting the city of Manaus in the Amazon region. COVID wards are at capacity, and many hospitals have now run out of oxygen. The Brazilian military says it's already shipped 8 tons of hospital supplies and expects to send more. On top of all that, fresh concern that a new variant of the virus has emerged in the area. Michael Fox has more from Brazil.
A woman in a red shirt and a white face mask walks through the parking lot of a hospital in Manaus. She's talking into her cell phone camera, and she's distraught. People, I'm asking you for mercy. We're in a deplorable situation, she says. The oxygen has simply run out in the entire unit. We don't have any oxygen, and a lot of people are dying. If you have oxygen available, bring it here to the urgent care unit at the Redenção Polyclinic. My God, there are a lot of people dying. Later in the same video, we see a crew of people carrying in 2 large green oxygen tanks from the back of a military police vehicle. She keeps repeating, "This is the situation. This is the situation. Only 2 oxygen tanks have arrived. The director is here in absolute despair. For the love of God," she says. This video is just one of dozens that went viral yesterday across Brazil as hospitals ran out of oxygen in Manaus, the capital of the Brazilian state of Amazonas. According to reports, dozens may have died yesterday because of the lack of oxygen. More than 200 patients are being transferred to hospitals in 6 different states. Health Minister Eduardo Pazuello said last night that along with the lack of oxygen, there were over 400 people on the wait list for ICUs in Manaus. André Basualto is a doctor at a private hospital there. He says the severity of the situation has caught medical professionals by surprise.
Primeiro acabaram os ventiladores, depois os leitos e, por fim, o menos esperado, o oxigênio.
He says, first we ran out of ventilators, then beds, and finally, and the least expected, oxygen. I believe we were already expecting a high number of patients, but not as we are actually seeing in practice. In this video, posted last week on TikTok, a backhoe operator looks out the windshield of his vehicle as he waits for 3 men to lower a coffin into the soft brown dirt. Simple wooden crosses mark hundreds of new graves that stretch back in seemingly endless rows across the field. He says, "You think this is a joke? A ton of people have died in just one day. Today is January 6th. It's not a joke. Use a mask." Manaus is in a tough spot. First, it's the only city in the state of Amazonas with ICU units. And that state is huge, roughly four times the size of Germany. This means that logistics and transportation are not easy. But Dr. André Basualto says the whole situation could have been avoided. He says, since the beginning of the pandemic, we have been alerting the population about the need for isolation and prevention, the use of masks and social distancing. However, what we saw was disregard by many and denialism regarding the imminent severity of the situation. Basualto points to inadequate planning and crowded stores and malls at the end of the year that helped the virus to spread. This week, many Brazilians took to social media with the hashtag lockdown. They blame President Jair Bolsonaro and his supporters for demanding the end of social restrictions and tighter measures that could have prevented the chaos now unfolding. Such measures were in effect briefly in late 2020, before State Governor Wilson Lima rolled them back under pressure. Lima has now suspended public transportation and instituted an overnight curfew. He has also requested air support from the United States to help ship oxygen tanks from elsewhere around Brazil. Venezuela, which shares a border with the state of Amazonas, has also promised to send in oxygen. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
In Venezuela, years of economic and political unrest have pushed several million people to leave the country. Many have migrated to the U.S. Their hopes for a stable future here rest heavily on the incoming Biden administration. The World's Daisy Contreras has our story.
Nurka Melendez left Venezuela 6 years ago. The situation there was getting worse every day, she says.
Yo sentí mucho miedo de, por primera vez en mi vida.
She said her neighborhood was becoming more pro-government and that she was being watched as she became more outspoken. She started fearing for her physical safety while standing in long lines to buy food.
Por primera vez, yo me sentí sola, que nadie me iba a defender.
She was able to get a visa and headed to New York with her husband and young son. Just until things got better, she thought, but they didn't. Melendez and her family are now hoping for asylum. Without that, they would have to return to Venezuela. That's not an option, Melendez says. Now she's hoping help is on the way. Here's Vice President-elect Kamala Harris.
I look forward to serving with Joe Biden. We have an immigration bill, for example, that we are going to be proposing as our first order of business.
Harris was speaking with Univision, a Spanish language network. President-elect Joe Biden promises to work fast on immigration reform, including granting Venezuelans like Melendez temporary protected status, or TPS. It's offered to people in the U.S. who can't safely return to their home countries, maybe because there's been a big earthquake or there's political upheaval. Many Venezuelans who've migrated to the U.S. would like this protection. TPS is criticized because it's actually not temporary, it's renewable. Some critics say that's a fast track to staying in the U.S. with papers. Others say something more permanent should be offered. Jill Marie Bussey is an attorney with the Catholic Legal Immigration Network.
So the long-term solution, obviously, is providing that pathway to lawful permanent residency and ultimately citizenship for undocumented. In the meantime, we need to give people the tools and the protection to help stabilize themselves.
The Trump administration has tried to end TPS protection for many immigrants in the U.S., including Haitians, Salvadorans, Nicaraguans, and Sudanese. And there have been court battles to stop the administration from doing that. Venezuelans don't have many options without temporary protection status, Bussey says. So they can either let their visas expire or try and seek political asylum. That can be really tough to get, but some groups say Venezuelans qualify. Gustavo Marcano with the Venezuelan embassy in Washington spoke with reporters in Florida recently. He just met with Venezuelans who were being kept in an immigration detention center. And he said they were people who fled Venezuelan instability. They need that temporary protection, Marcano said. But with a long to-do list for Biden and Congress, expanding TPS could take some time. Immigration advocates want something Biden can sign on his very first day in office. Nurka Melendez, the Venezuelan asylum seeker, says she's prepared for any outcome. She now has a job in tech and runs a nonprofit helping Venezuelans in her community.
I learned that no matter your situation, if you want to do something, you just do it.
But she also doesn't lose out hope that one day she's able to return to the life she left in Venezuela. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. In Uganda, election officials are counting the votes from yesterday's presidential election. The incumbent, President Yoweri Museveni, appears to have taken an early lead. But the leading opposition candidate, pop singer-turned-politician Bobi Wine, is alleging fraud. He also said today that his home is under siege by government troops. The World's Halima Gikandi is in Uganda's capital, Kampala. We're speaking to her by phone. Halima, I know you spoke earlier today with Bobi Wine. What did he have to say?
Yeah, so today I visited his home, which I have to mention is surrounded by the military. They've essentially set up a checkpoint right in front of his home and are keeping tabs on who enters and leaves. And he, in fact, it's been like that for at least a week, that heavy police and military presence. And when it comes to the election, he essentially called it a sham. The election results are still being counted. The final results won't come out until tomorrow, but he said many of the election observers from his party weren't able to actually access polling stations yesterday, and there's a big question about whether the actual polling results from across the country, if that's what will actually be sent to the National Tallying Center here in Kampala.
Hmm. Election results were expected to come out tomorrow. What's the government saying about the process?
Well, the Electoral Commission, which runs the election, has been saying that, you know, the process is going smoothly, that there really aren't big problems. I mean, again, election and votes are still being counted. And again, remember, there's no internet, so we're all just hearing results being announced by the Electoral Commission about different areas in the country. We still haven't heard election results from Sierra and Kampala and the surrounding area. I mean, that's kind of considered an area where Bobi Wine has a lot of support. So some people I spoke with don't really feel confident in the election because of that, because they haven't seen results come from here where we are now. And also because, again, there's no internet. So we're all relying on the radio and TV. And vis-a-vis that, what information is coming from the Electoral Commission directly?
Is there no internet because there's no internet, or is it because the government shut it down?
Good question. I haven't heard the government say specifically directly that they're the ones who shut it down. But, I mean, Uganda is a well-developed country. I've been here multiple times with few problems with my internet. So the question is, who else could do that? That said, earlier this week, President Museveni did admit that the government had restricted social media. So it isn't a far kind of cry to suggest that the government was the one that shut down the internet. But they haven't said that directly. And yes, the internet is shut down.
And was it shut down on Election Day?
It was shut down the day before Election Day, the evening before Election Day.
You've been out and about in Kampala today speaking with voters. What's the atmosphere in the capital, and what are you hearing from people?
Yeah, well, in the capital, it's a bit quiet still. A lot of people seem to be at home. I mean, it's different from yesterday where we have long lines around polling stations. And here again, because the internet shut down, I've walked through certain areas and markets where people are crowded around small stores that have large televisions, and they're all eagerly watching the election results come in. Just recently, I walked by this young kid who was carrying this giant radio, and that was giving updates from local media. So people are watching. People are waiting for the election results to come in, and I think we'll have to see what the reaction is tomorrow when the final announcement is made.
The World's Halima Gikandi speaking to us from Kampala, Uganda. Thanks so much, Halima.
Thank you.
Since roughly the end of World War II, Germany and the United States have had a tight alliance. After the war, the U.S. sponsored the Marshall Plan, a massive economic investment that helped transform Germany from a defeated Nazi pariah state responsible for the Holocaust into an economic powerhouse and a strong liberal democracy. For more than 70 years now, the United States has essentially been a model for Germany. So when a violent mob in Washington seized the Capitol, how did that look to Germans? We asked Michael Streck to talk to us about that. He writes for the German weekly Stern. Streck knows American politics well because he lived here for several years as a Washington correspondent. He's now based in Hamburg. Michael, what was your emotional reaction when you heard what was going on in Washington last Wednesday? I'm assuming you got online and watched it unfold. What went through your mind?
Well, that's correct. I was basically glued to the TV in shock and petrified in a way. And first of all, and obviously wondering about the lack of law enforcement and where were they, you know? And it had this strange resemblance of a coup d'etat in a way. I mean, the footage of policemen and police women opening gates and even ushering people in, I really didn't see that coming. And it was pretty clear what these people had in mind. And you could just tell by Googling it, two clicks on the web and there it was. So one should have known. And I mean, 30,000 Trump supporters gathering at the very same day when Biden's victory was made official in the Capitol, it was not rocket science. So I was really, as most of my countrymen and most of the world, I was really in shock, I have to say.
In your own life, has the U.S. been a kind of model for you or a country you looked up to?
Absolutely. I mean, we spent several years in the States, and I worked as a journalist there. But in general, I have a very special relationship to the U.S. other than that, because my father was 9 years old at the end of World War II, and he had a terrible accident. He fell onto an iron fence and was literally impaled. He was rescued by two GIs who took him to the hospital, and they saved his life. So I grew up being extremely grateful, and my whole generation looked up to America. And as you rightly said, Germany wouldn't be in this strong and economic stable position without the constant help and support of the U.S., and there's no doubt about that. And the U.S. coined our culture, and it's music, Hollywood, you name it.
Germany, as you well know, has its own extremist and anti-democratic forces these days. How would you describe their influence currently?
You might have heard we had a similar situation in Germany, in Berlin, here back in September, when some hundreds of protesters, most of them Corona conspiracy theorists, mixing up with neo-Nazis and hooligans, tried to storm the Reichstag and were fought off by a couple of brave cops. Actually, as you rightly say, there are similarities with one big difference, I have to say, and that being the right wing in Germany has a political party, the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, Alternative for Germany, which got more than 12% in the past election, which is really quite a lot. But at least these guys are basically under the control of a still functioning parliament. That makes it a bit easier. In the States, with a two-party system, the Republicans are prone to attract these people, and it might, who knows, come to a split someday between the moderate Republicans and the radical wing. I think that's a big difference in dealing with the right-wing threat.
Michael Streck writes for the German weekly Stern. He's been speaking to us from Hamburg. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a nice day.
There's plenty of news to sort through these days. We get it. Let's handle some of that for you. Start your morning with a quick hit of news stories from around the globe. We'll do the digging. Sign up for our morning newsletter, theworld.org/newsletters. You're listening to The World. India is about to set off on the world's most ambitious vaccination program ever. Israelis wrestle with the word apartheid, and Turkey's reservoirs are running dry.
We have drought everywhere. And of course, we have water shortage in all of our cities.
In part because climate change is altering rainfall patterns. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A shocking criminal investigation involving U.S. and Mexican officials has come to a close. Mexican prosecutors have declined to pursue charges against a former defense minister who was arrested by the Drug Enforcement Administration in Los Angeles last year. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador is accusing American investigators of having, quote, fabricated the accusations against his country's former defense minister.
Pues yo lo que veo es Muy poco profesionalismo.
That's López Obrador in a press conference this morning saying the DEA's agents acted rashly and lacked professionalism. This is a case that will surely strain collaborations between law enforcement agencies on both sides of the border for some time. For more, we turn to the world's Jorge Valencia, who's in Mexico City. Jorge, explain to us who the person is at the center of this case and what the case is against him.
The person we are discussing here is former General Salvador Cienfuegos. He served in the military for decades, and he retired as the defense minister in 2018. Now, just a few months ago, the Drug Enforcement Administration arrested him while he was vacationing in Los Angeles. And they said that General Cienfuegos had been using his position to help an organized crime group traffic cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, to the United States. They arrested him, they took him to New York, they were going to put him on trial, but there were diplomatic tensions behind the scenes. And after a few weeks, General Cienfuegos was returned to his home in Mexico.
So what did Mexican officials indicate at the time the former general was returned?
They were very upset that this investigation had taken place and that he had been arrested without alerting them beforehand. But they said they took it very seriously. They asked for all the evidence and they handed it over to Mexican prosecutors. Now, 2 months later, the Attorney General's office says that they found no wrongdoing and they exonerated Cienfuegos of everything he'd been accused of. So I spoke with Julio Sabines Chester King. He lectures at the National Autonomous University on subjects of national security. And he questioned whether the evidence that the DEA had brought forward was strong enough.
Just imagining that the Minister of Defense was using his own phone to have communications with a low-level criminal, it's just absurd. So I felt justice has been served.
So why are people upset that Mexico's attorney general is not pursuing charges?
Well, because many people see this as corruption reaching the highest levels of Mexican government and authorities doing nothing about it. So I spoke with former DEA agent Mike Vigil. He's retired now, but he used to head investigations for the DEA here in Mexico.
This, to me, is a total case of impunity because the case was strong. And there's a process that we follow. You know, we as investigators develop the case, the evidence. And if we fabricated evidence in any case, we would be the ones going to prison.
So what is this evidence that he's so certain about?
The evidence primarily was cell phone communication between General Cienfuegos and members of an organization known as H2, which is an organized crime group primarily operating in areas near the city of Guadalajara. Now, Carol, at this point, the Justice Department is saying that they reserve the right to put Cienfuegos on trial, which is kind of like saying that if he steps foot in the United States again, they're probably going to arrest him. And moving forward, collaborations between the DEA and Mexican officials are frayed. These collaborations have been a key part of law enforcement in both countries for decades. But Vigil says that he believes that all of that will change because of this case.
The world's Jorge Valencia speaking to us from Mexico City. Thanks, Jorge.
Thank you, Carol.
Apartheid is a powerful word, not to be thrown around lightly. So when an Israeli human rights organization recently said that Israel is an apartheid regime, it angered the Israeli government. Many Palestinians will point out that they've been using the word apartheid to describe their situation for years. Hagai Al-Ad is the executive director of the Israeli organization B'Tselem. Hagai, you've been working on human rights issues in Israel for many years. What brought you to this point where you're using the word apartheid to describe the Israeli government?
We have decided to use this word because it is the correct term to describe the reality between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea in the entire area that is under Israel's control. And within this statement, there are two major points that will be understood. One, there are no two regimes between the river and the sea. The perception that Israel is somehow a democracy on one side of the Green Line to which a temporary occupation project is attached on the other side of the Green Line, that perception has become completely untethered from reality.
And when you say from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, you're referring, of course, to the occupied territories, the West Bank, across the state of Israel, Gaza Strip, to the Mediterranean.
And Israel proper inside the Green Line. In fact, which together make up four different subunits, In each and every one of them, there's a different subset of less rights that Palestinians get from Israel. It's different if you're a citizen inside the Green Line or if you're a permanent resident in the only part of the West Bank that has been formally annexed, East Jerusalem, or if you live in the rest of the West Bank, or if you live in the Gaza Strip, which is controlled from the outside by Israel. So if you're a Palestinian, in each and every one of these subunits, you will have a different situation. While for Jewish Israelis, it doesn't matter. If you live on one side of the Green Line or another, you will receive the full set of rights and protections from the state.
Apartheid is a very specific word associated with South Africa, of course. What does it mean in the Israeli-Palestinian context?
So apartheid is both the historical memory, the historical reference point of the situation in South Africa. But apartheid is also its own independent political analysis of the qualities of a regime. If a regime works to promote and cement the supremacy of one group of people over another, it is apartheid. And that's the second phase of the B'Tselem analysis, not only that there is one regime, but also to look closely and with great nuance, detail, and factual accuracy at Israel's policies vis-a-vis Jews on the one hand and vis-a-vis Palestinians on the other hand, and to identify them for what they are.
A lot of Israelis have heard this accusation before that there's an apartheid regime at work in Israel regarding the Palestinians. And I imagine they roll their eyes when people on the Israeli left in particular use the word apartheid. And some of them will say that by naming and calling Israel an apartheid state, you're actually encouraging Israel's worst enemies and maybe even anti-Semitism. What do you say to that?
First, this is not an accusation. This is a description of reality. I appreciate it is unpleasant, but if we do not call things by the proper name, it's so much harder to address the underlying injustice that needs to be addressed. The Israeli government's accusations of equating accurate criticism of its policies with anti-Semitism have everything to do with trying to silence the criticism so that it will be possible to continue with this reality with impunity, which is the way things have been going so far.
What have you heard from Palestinians since you put out this report?
There has been a lot of interest in this position, and I also feel a lot of enthusiasm. I think that at the same time, it comes with this genuine sense of bitterness, which I can identify with, because as I said earlier, this is the first time for us to be saying this. This is absolutely not the first time that Palestinians have been saying this. And even though that has been the situation for quite some time, it hasn't been accepted and it hasn't been addressed the way it should have been addressed.
Hagai Al-Ad is the executive director of B'Tselem. Thanks for being with us, Hagai.
Thank you very much.
For the first time in nearly 70 years, this week, the U.S. put a woman to death for her crimes. Another inmate, a man, was executed in Indiana last night. That makes 12 prisoners killed since the Trump administration resumed federal capital punishment last year. Meanwhile, much of the rest of the globe is going in the opposite direction. Amnesty International says in 2019, the number of executions worldwide hit a 10-year low. And now, as the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, one of the last remaining former Soviet republics with the death penalty has abolished it.
The number of countries to ban the death penalty has rapidly grown in recent years. More than two-thirds have now abolished capital punishment in law or practice. The newest member to join these ranks is a Central Asian country the size of Western Europe, the Republic of Kazakhstan. Some say by abolishing the death penalty, Kazakhstan is returning to its cultural roots. Long ago, the country didn't have prisons. There was a system of collective responsibility where tribes and families would compensate victims. But during much of the 70 years of Soviet rule, the jails in Kazakhstan were full. Anwar Nurakhmet is a legal advocate in Almaty, the country's largest city.
30 years ago, when Kazakhstan got independence, we had one of the highest rates of population in prison. There was about 100,000 people in prison. There were some political prisoners, but most of them were for minor crimes.
Nurakhmet says the severity of Soviet criminal justice made people in a newly independent Kazakhstan eager for reform. The country put measures in place to reduce the number of people incarcerated. And in 2003, the Kazakhstan government established a moratorium on capital punishment. Nurakhmet says many people supported that move because of well-known corruption in the courts.
When we have such flaws in the judicial system, there could be mistakes.
Others say the Kazakhstan government has been trying to satisfy the international community to attract Western investment and tourism.
The push towards reducing the use of death penalty came from outside, basically from the West.
Alexei Troshev, associate professor of political science at the University of Kazakhstan, says the international community has always made it clear that if Kazakhstan wanted to join the global club of enlightened nations, the death penalty had to go.
But this is only mentioned when Kazakhstan communicates with international actors. Domestically, this issue is never mentioned because the elite and the law enforcement officers, most of them favor death penalty.
He says that's because of some high-profile crimes that have angered the public. Those include the 2018 case of beloved Kazakhstani figure skater and Olympic bronze medalist Denis Ten. He caught thieves stealing the mirrors off his car in Almaty.
He confronted them. He started chasing the thieves and they stopped and they used the knife. So they stabbed him into the leg and then he bled and bled and died.
Troshev says it shocked the public. When the two men convicted in Ten's death were sentenced to 18 years in prison, many people felt they got off easy. There's now just one man on death row as Kazakhstan formally abolishes capital punishment. He's convicted of killing 10 people, including 8 police officers. His sentence will be commuted to life in prison. Kazakhstanis who still support the death penalty point out that the United States is accepted on the world stage, despite its use of capital punishment. Sergei Siapin is an associate professor at the Kimmich University of Law in Almaty.
There is the death penalty in the United States. If they have it, why should we abolish it?
Besides that, Siapin says, the international community's focus on ending the death penalty sometimes seems to eclipse other human rights issues.
Let me put it this way. Indeed, Kazakhstan has quite some problematic human rights record.
Human Rights Watch says dissidents are unfairly jailed and there are limits on freedom of speech and religion. This week, Kazakhstan's main opposition party led protests against a new law they say inhibits the right to freely assemble. Some demonstrators were detained just before parliamentary elections on Monday. The ruling party went on to win in a landslide. International observers said the circumstances infringed on voters' rights and denied them a genuine choice. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Turkey is having its worst drought in a decade. Water levels are critically low. Its biggest city, Istanbul, only has about 6 weeks of water left in its reservoirs. In the countryside, crop failures and water rationing could be right around the corner. I'm joined by Akgün İlhan, a water management expert at the Istanbul Policy Center, to discuss this. Akgün, the current drought sounds really bad. I mean, just how bad are we talking?
Well, it's really bad. Over 90% of the country suffers from different levels of drought, ranging from exceptionally dry to abnormally dry. So we have drought everywhere.
If Istanbul only has about 6 weeks of water left in its reservoirs, what's going to happen if the reservoirs run dry? I mean, what's the backup plan?
If it continues this way, we might have to go to regular water cuts at certain hours of the day. Or maybe we can also run compulsory daily water use limits or water rationing, but I must say that many local authorities would avoid rationing or water cuts as long as they could, because lacking continuous access to cheap tap water in cities is perceived by public as the most unacceptable failure of a local government. Hmm. And we see before local elections in Turkey how mayoral candidates promise to lower water prices if they are to be elected.
So they're going to keep the water running because they don't want to lose votes.
They will do it at any cost.
How much of what's happening now is attributed to climate change?
We have it actually since the late 1980s. We have these drought periods. This is a result of global climate change, of course. But what we face now is to a large extent lack of adaptation to climate change. It is true that we receive less precipitation in Turkey now, but on top of that, we also make very poor use of the water falling on cities. Natural water cycle, which is already interrupted by climate change, is affected also by urban surfaces that are sealed with asphalt and concrete materials in the cities.
So you're saying when it rains, instead of that water going back into the earth, it's running off because it's dropping on concrete. So you're losing that water absorption into the soil.
Exactly. So because of this, water cannot meet soil and feed underground water resources, you know. And also, as a result of hundreds of dams built on almost all rivers in the country, natural water recycle is almost destroyed, you know. This is another problem. Unfortunately, not much has been done so far. I think the missing element here is the political will.
If you had the ear of the Turkish government, what steps would you recommend it take to create some sort of long-term solutions for these critical water shortages, which are linked to climate change?
In the age of climate change, the most sustainable strategy is to reduce water demand instead of increasing the water supply. Local authorities can make greywater reuse and rain harvesting technologies obligatory for the new constructions in the cities, you know. Local governments should also improve urban green areas management for fixing the already damaged water cycle.
Do you think the Turkish government is doing enough to address climate change?
No, of course not. Turkey is putting economic growth over everything, over ecological and social issues. So, you know, Turkey should ratify the Paris Agreement and take the necessary measures towards zero carbon emissions. Because there is only one planet, and this planet is not only for humans, for us, but also for the future generations, other living beings. We all live in the same house, and as Greta Thunberg says, our house is on fire and there's no time to lose.
Akgün İlhan is a water management expert at the Istanbul Policy Center. She's been speaking to us from Istanbul. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Only two nations, the United States and India, have reported more than 10 million cases of COVID-19. But now India is gearing up to go big with its vaccine campaign. As the world's Alana Gordon reports, the country is about to launch the largest vaccination effort in history.
Prime Minister Narendra Modi says India is ready.
Balki duniya ka sabse bada vaccination program.
He recently said that he knows the world is watching. Tomorrow morning, Modi will kick off the drive, addressing thousands of vaccine sites in a virtual event. The aim is to vaccinate 300 million people in the coming months. For context, about 35 million people globally have gotten a vaccine so far. This is how it's going to work. The first to get vaccinated will be health workers. Dr. Samir Chandretre is president of the India Medical Association in the city of Nashik.
A systematic list will be declared and we will be getting a message on our phone that you are supposed to report this center and this time.
Public hospitals and clinics will be administering the vaccines, and hundreds of workers will be called into each site each day. Chandretre says health workers have been hit especially hard.
Out of the 1,250 members of our association, more than 400 have already been infected with COVID.
Yes, a third of the members of his association have already gotten COVID, including him, back in May. Dr. Nayan Jani is the state immunization officer for the western state of Gujarat. He says this campaign may seem ambitious, but India has a strong history of successful mass vaccinations.
So there is a well-established system, and our health workers are very well trained for this.
He'd know, as he's overseen lots of campaigns. India has been doing national vaccine campaigns since the 80s for measles, polio, and other childhood diseases. Another big reason India is able to scale up so fast is because the country is home to the world's largest vaccine manufacturer, the Serum Institute. The company is rolling out two vaccines that received Indian approval. One is from Oxford and AstraZeneca, and the other is from an Indian company, Bharat Biotech. Some worry that they're moving ahead too fast. Dr. Anant Ban is a global health researcher and bioethicist based in central India.
There is this interesting scenario because of the pandemic that permissions have been given when routinely you would have tended to wait for efficacy data to be available.
Ban says the current data on the Oxford vaccine has come from abroad, while the other vaccine has yet to complete phase 3 trials.
It would have been good to probably have transparency on these decisions, but that is not the case.
It's unclear which regions and centers will get which vaccine. The government's making those decisions. Dr. Chandratre, the doctor who had COVID in May, says he hopes that as the public sees health workers getting vaccinated, they'll gain more confidence too.
That is how the trust is built, by setting up examples.
And he hopes it will become clear the benefits far outweigh the risks. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Curious about U.S.-German relations post-World War II? Or what about something less heavy, like the origins of the cuckoo clock? For many of us, the first place we go is Wikipedia, the online encyclopedia curated by volunteers and open to all. Well, today, Wikipedia turns 20. Here's co-founder Jimmy Wales.
We've always had the vision of a free encyclopedia. We've always been community-driven. Obviously, from day one, when the only words on the site were me typing hello world to get started, to today, with millions and millions of entries, that has changed. As we get bigger and more mature, it becomes possible to do more things and make sure that things are as good as they possibly can be.
Wales is this week's guest on the podcast The Economist Asks, brought to us by our partners at Economist Radio. Anne McElvoy is the host, and she joins us now from London. And as Jimmy implies there in that clip, the goal of Wikipedia was altruistic, knowledge for all, open collaborations. Remind us of the basics of how Wikipedia works. Who writes and edits all these entries?
Well, really, it uses a vast network effect around the world of human knowledge. It has hundreds of thousands of volunteers who will add to a subject that's covered or perhaps start a new one. And humans oversee all these edits rather crucially so that they can't fall into the mechanical hands of bots. They're seen by someone who is moderating, a thoughtful person. Jimmy Wales says they should be kind and understanding, not combative, but curious, so that must be quite a difficult job spec. And he also says, well, we do know that Wikipedia shouldn't only be written from one angle or a limited number of angles. So it shouldn't be looked after by people who are naturally politically one way or the other, or as he says, by tech geek men.
What about the criticism over bias or misinformation? Does Wales acknowledge some of the shortcomings and errors in some Wikipedia entries?
Yes, he does. He does accept that Wikipedia needed to grow and it needed to get more sophisticated in how it harvested its information and its range of people gathering it. And he does say, well, if you look at the rise of fake news, of propagandistic news outlets pushing particular agendas, well, Wikipedia may still have questions over some of the entries you read on there, and at least you could flag those much more prominently than you used to be able to do.
You couldn't write a Wikipedia article and say, my source is Wikipedia. That's a bit nonsense, right? We depend on other sources, and we are an open system, so errors can be there and sometimes persist longer than we would like. But in general, I think Wikipedia is pretty good. And I think for most uses, it's completely normal. Everyone is using it. What I always say to people is, look, if you see where the Wikipedians have written, you know, the neutrality of this article has been disputed, that's a famous line, or the following section doesn't cite any sources, okay, take that seriously. We're warning you, like, hey, this is not done. This is not really something that you can count on.
I like that term, Wikipedians. That's, of course, Jimmy Wales of Wikipedia speaking there to Anne McElvoy of the podcast Economist Asks. And social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook are under fire for helping spread misinformation and fake news, and there have been cries of censorship. Among these tech giants, where does Jimmy Wales see Wikipedia?
I think he sees Wikipedia as a sort of safe space away from that very noisy, very bitter and fevered argument that is playing out about the responsibility of the big tech giants and their platforms for a lot of what is going on in the divisiveness in our societies. He made one quite interesting boast, however. He said that while he would never become a billionaire out of Wikipedia, he said it will outlive the other tech giants. And he saw a difference there between Facebook, Twitter, et al. And Wikipedia. Well, I suppose we'd have to be around a very long time to be able to do a search for that.
Absolutely. Anne McElvoy, host of The Economist Asks. You can listen to more of Anne's conversation with Jimmy Wales, co-founder of Wikipedia, on the podcast The Economist Asks. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Anne, thanks a lot.
Lovely to be with you.
That's all for us this week from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend. We're back on Monday. From PRX.